Sure, man.
Okay.
Sure, man.
Okay.
Sure, man.
Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
Rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America at this moment.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Criminal Law Presents CAF Chats. We have an interesting role reversal today where I'm doing the introduction, and I'm going to introduce...
Lieutenant Colonel Dave Seagraves, United States Marine Corps.
And I'm Major Dustin Morgan, United States Army. An interesting role reversal. I'm going to interview Colonel Seagraves today, and we're going to talk about the case of In Re Biem. Sir, why don't you talk to us a little bit about what the CAF did in this interesting-sounding case?
All right, so this case was argued on December 5th, 2023, and decided on April 3rd, 2024. This case was all about, well, as certified to the court, it was about the psychotherapist privilege and the procedures for producing non-privileged mental health records. However, as written in this opinion, this case is about justiciability, or whether a matter can be decided by a court, or perhaps when a party is standing to request a remedy. But how did we get here?
Yeah, interesting. So... if our listeners should know right off the bat, this is not United States versus Smith or United States versus Jones or United States versus whoever, the accused. When you see a case that's titled In Re Biem, you should know that we got here in a funny way. We got here because of a writ petition. So as we know from other episodes, you know, namely YB versus Fink, episodes where special victims are involved, the Special Victims Council in this case filed a writ. And from there, we got to the CAF through another interesting means. Because as we know from previous opinions, a victim cannot petition the CAF if they lose a writ at the Court of Criminal Appeals. So because of that, we have our first TJAG certification that follows that. Article 67 is interesting that allows any judge advocate general of any service to tell the CAF, you will answer a question, or at least they try to tell them they will answer a question as we see here today. So interesting way to get here, interesting appellate history. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the facts, sir, and kind of the underlying issue that we have going on and why we got to the CAF with this case.
Hey, thanks, Dustin. And how we got here, the procedural posture is going to be very important on how the CAF actually addresses this case. But going back to the beginning, Lieutenant Commander Bailey was charged with two specifications of abusive sexual contact and three specifications of assault consummated by battery, with the victim of all these charges and specifications being the petitioner, BM, who was a major in the Army at the time. Now, Lieutenant Commander Bailey's defense counsel requested mental health records of the victim, specifically any diagnoses, prescription medications, and treatments the victim had received. So, colloquially, the courts are now kind of calling these mental health records as Millett matters, which stems from the CAF case of U.S. v. Millett, which is another episode on this fine podcast, where the CAF gave clarification on the extent of the psychotherapist privilege. The CAF narrowly construed the privilege to only include those communications from the patient to the mental health provider for treatment and protected records, meaning only those mental health records that memorialized what a patient said to the mental health provider. The CAF expressly said mental health diagnoses, medications, and treatments were not covered by the privilege. Now, this request by defense actually happened right on the heels of U.S. v. Millett. So this is kind of a burgeoning territory where all sides, all parties, including the military judge, was trying to figure out how to handle these requests. So the military judge reviewed the request under the rule for court-martial 703, which governs production, ruling that the defense counsel had shown these records were relevant and necessary as required under RCM 703. The judge ordered the appropriate custodian at the military treatment facility to turn over the diagnoses, prescriptions for medications, any other mental health treatments the victim was receiving. Or I should say, the judge actually ordered the government to go to the mental treatment facility and get that information.
Yeah, and after Millett, this has become like quite convoluted, right? Because you have 513 saying that we can't ever talk about what a patient tells a psychotherapist. I mean, that's still hands off. But now we have this, I can't even call it a gray area, because the CAF has explicitly said when a doctor diagnoses you with something or gives you a prescription, that's not technically a conversation.
So it's kind of like a one-way privilege, just from the patient to the psychotherapist. If we remember back in U.S. v. Millett, they cited Upjohn, the Supreme Court opinion, that everything else was underlying facts. So, again, back to the military judge's order, the military judge ordered this stuff produced, but explicitly said, do not turn over any records of actual communications.
Yeah, but how often is that happening? Because it's so inextricably tied, it seems like. And I think this case is illustrative for the peril that awaits anyone that gets an order like this.
Indeed. There's a whole line of cases, most of them now currently at the Court of Criminal Appeals for the different military forces about, how everyone is handling these things. And inevitably, we think most courts are finding out that these treatment facilities are intermingling these records when they give them back. And sure enough, that's what happened in this case. So the military judge reviewed what was produced in camera and discovered there was, in fact, privileged materials within these records. She continued to go through the records, providing a redacted copy to all counsel. She provided an unredacted version to the SVC or VLC, I'm sorry, Special Victims Counsel would be if it's the Army. This is was a Navy case, so it's actually Victims Legal Counsel, so the victim's attorney, if you will, with the privileged portions highlighted, and asked if BM was still asserting her psychotherapist privilege, which she did. The military judge then decided that privileged materials she saw included matters constitutionally required to be turned over to defense. And since there was no exception providing the military judge to turn over the materials to defense, she followed the Navy and Marine Corps Court of Appeals opinion or guidance in JM v. Peyton O'Brien. In that case, the military judge had the same situation, had materials that was constitutionally required, but no exception to turn it over to the defense. And in that case, the judge abated the court-martial.
Yeah, because in Peyton O'Brien, the Navy Marine Corps court saying, remember, we're not in 412 land where we're talking about relevance. We're talking about a level of privilege that's asserted between the privilege holder and the person that they're speaking to. This isn't the case amongst all services, though, is it, sir?
No, U.S. v. Tinsley and the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, we should speak a little bit differently. They have said there is no constitutional requirement,
right.
So there's no need for a constitutional exception, whereas the Navy Marine Corps Court of Appeals and Pate O'Brien has said that things can still be constitutionally required. We'll find out more about that later.
Sure.
But an important thing to think about this is that under the federal rules of evidence, a lot of your privileges are determined by case law. But here in the military, we do have the 500 series of the military rules of evidence where our privileges are codified. And as we've talked about, the CAF has really strictly construed that language. So, all right, we find out there's privileged materials in there. The victim does not want to waive privilege. And so the military judge abates or pushes pause, if you will, on the court martial. The victim, BM, then petitioned the Navy Marine Corps Court of Appeals for a writ of mandamus ordering the military judge to seal or destroy all the petitioner's mental health records, to lift the abatement order so the court-martial could proceed, and ask them to direct the military judge to recuse herself from the court-martial proceedings because of actual and implied bias. And finally, to reinstate this court-martial case of trial with a new military judge. Now, a writ of mandamus is essentially asking a superior court to order a judge to take an action.
Yeah, it's basically here the CCA forcing the judge, like, hey, you can't abate this. You're going to have the court-martial go forward, as opposed to a writ of prohibition, which is where the superior court's telling the subordinate court, you can't do what you just did. You have to take that ruling back and proceed as if you never made it. So two lesser seen vehicles, especially in the military system, but something that we're seeing more and more in the SVC VLC world.
Yeah, and as we're finding out, the requirements for a writ of mandamus are very hard to meet. So the standard they must show, the petitioner must show, is that there's no other adequate means of relief. The right to issuance of a writ is clear and indisputable, a very high standard, and the issuance of the writ is appropriate under the circumstances. So the NMCCA did not like the fact that the military judge had continued to review the materials after her first discovering they contained privileged materials. didn't like it, but ultimately denied the writ of mandamus. The NMCCA denied the writ, saying the mental health records were sealed, and the military judge did not abuse her discretion in ordering the abatement. They said her inadvertent review of privileged materials did not in any respect waive petitioner's privilege, but it did alert the military judge to the fact that the records contained evidence of both confabulation and inconsistent statements made by the petitioner, which would be constitutionally required to be produced because the records were exculpatory. And they said, we find that the military judge's decision was within the range of choices reasonably arising from the applicable facts and the law.
Yeah, think about what they're saying there. So to, for the listeners that aren't familiar with some of these terms and the way that these records reviews often go. So confabulation is the argument that the victim could be thinking about different times where bad things were committed against him or her, and then imprinting it onto whatever they're making the allegation with now. So imprinting past memories into into the reality of what's happening there. Pretty important to know if you're a defense counsel that if someone was doing that, that'd be a pretty good defense in most cases, that they're not really perceiving it correctly. They're thinking of something bad that happened to them before, and that's what they're really alleging, not what's happening now. And then inconsistent statements, I mean, that's where defense counsel make their money. I mean, because in cases where credibility is key, if you can show that the victim, the government's primary witness in most of these kind of cases, has been inconsistent before, you can call into direct question their credibility. And if their credibility is, you know, rightfully called into question, you probably get a not guilty verdict most of the time.
That's right. Military Rules of Evidence 613, prior inconsistent statements. It's directly in the wheelhouse of defense counsel everywhere, attacking that credibility. So they also ruled that an order for disqualification is not right because the case is abated. So it's not going anywhere, so there's no need to remove the judge. So next, BM tried to petition the CAF to review the case, but the court dismissed it for lack of jurisdiction. We just talked
about this. Yeah, as we know, MW, YB, like the court has defined what this writ jurisdiction is. And YB, it's okay for an accused to bring it after they lose a writ at the CCAs. MW, a victim cannot raise a writ to the CAF if they lose the writ petition at the CCA.
So as I said, in those cases that the Navy TJAG, or the Judge Advocate General of the service, could actually certify these questions to the CAF, and the Navy TJAG did so. So the issue that was certified to the CAF was whether, one, MRA 513, the psychotherapist privilege, governs the procedures for production and in-camera review of patient records that, quote-unquote, pertain to communications to a psychotherapist. The military judge applied RCM 703 to order production and conduct an in-camera review of Major BM's diagnoses and treatment. They said, did the military judge err by applying the narrow scope of the MRE 513 alpha privilege defined in Millett to bypass the procedural requirements of MRE 513E?
So a lot to unpack there. So primarily what this question's asking is, are these issues where there are patient psychotherapist records out there that involve a diagnosis, are we in privilege land under MRE 513? Are we in pure discovery slash production land with 703? So are these just records that the defense can ask for, say where they are, describe them with enough particularity, meet the rule for court-martial 703 analysis, and just stop there? Or do you have to analyze these records under MRE 513? Do you have to have an in-camera review? Do you have to meet the standards that are there in MRE 513? 703 is much easier than 513.
Much easier. So MRE 513... if you look at Echo 3 there, it's an impossible puzzle to meet about. Yeah. I mean, it's very hard. Suffice to say, if you're in 513 land, it's going to be very hard for anyone to get these records.
Yeah, the showing that the defense counsel would have to make on behalf of their client is they've tried to look other places, that they've been unsuccessful in doing that. The records exist, that there's some exception that they can meet for showing them. I mean, it is a pretty tough standard to meet. A near impossible standard to meet, like, in all practical reality.
And worse yet, what they said in U.S. v. Tinsley is that first one, that there's something in there that's admissible. And then the third requirement, that whatever's in that file is not merely cumulative of what you ever have, of what you have, is impossible to prove unless you have the whole file already.
Yeah, and 703 is just, can you show us where the records are, and are they material or relevant to your case? That's a chasm of difference. That's a much, much lower showing than would be required under MRE 513. So an important question to answer, like, where are we when we talk about these records?
All right. And two, the second issue certified to the CAF was the Army Court of Criminal Appeals held that there was no constitutional exception to MRE 513. The Navy Marine Corps Court of Appeals ruled the constitutional required production of mental health records. You know, the resulting disparity in the appellate precedent precludes uniform application of the law. Should JM v. Payne O'Brien be overturned? Essentially, citing that there's a circuit split. As we talked about before, Yusuf V. Tinsley, the Army Court of Criminal Appeals says, hey, you know, there's no such thing as a necessary, you know, constitutional exception. You know, if it's privileged, it's privileged. You know, just march on. If you're Navy Marine Corps Court of Appeals, they have, if you find stuff in there that you believe is constitutionally required, halt.
Yeah, because in the past few years, I mean, past few may be generous, quite a few years ago now, the constitutional exception for MRE 513 was written out of it. And the question remained, like, can you write the Constitution out of a military rule of evidence? Or isn't the Constitution always there kind of as an overriding principle? Again, another really important question that should seem to be answered by the highest court in the military. Do we get an answer, sir?
So, I think we just had a great discussion of all these different questions, and we did not get an answer. So, what we did get was that, for reasons that we will explain, we cannot fully answer either of these questions because of the unusual procedural posture of this case. We conclude, however, that the decision of the NMCCA should be affirmed. So, essentially, as we'll get into in a second, said because of the procedural posture, we're not going to touch these two questions. But NMCCA got it right.
So we don't know going forward what the answer to those two questions are. But so why not? So we talked about how this case got here in an interesting way. What about how we got here prevents the court from issuing an opinion? Why is it that they're not answering what the Navy TJAG certified to them?
So the court goes on to say that they definitely do not do advisory opinions. And that's really what got us here. Is that because the biggest thing here really is looking at lifting the abatement order. And so they said, really, the question is whether the named victim initially had standing to challenge the abatement order by filing an extraordinary writ to NMCCA. They pointed out there that the government did not agree with the victim, or at least they did not seek any relief in saying that the production of these records should be governed by MRE 513E instead of 703.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because the government wasn't opposing the abatement here. So during in their briefs and during their oral argument, they don't ask the court to lift the abatement. So it's almost as if they don't have a stake in the outcome even. They really didn't take a strong side, I guess is the best way to put it. Like when I listened to the oral arguments and read the briefs, I was like, well, I don't really understand where they're coming out on this side. I mean, it's pretty clear where the victim was coming out on this case, but they don't really have a stake in the game.
That's right. So, and the CAV looked at exactly, you know, what standing victims have. Again, they looked at 6 Bravo Echo 1. You know, they authorized the victim of an offense to seek a writ of mandamus from a CCA only in specified circumstances.
Yeah, and that's talking about Article 6 Bravo of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, relatively new. It's a creation of the last 8 years or so that gives victims certain rights along the court-martial process, like the right to be heard, the right to be protected. And along with those rights is the right to appeal certain decisions that affect them. So that's why we got here. We got to the CCAs, at least, through the writ of mandamus. That's a vehicle that Article 6B allows for us to challenge when a ruling in under MRE 412 or 513 doesn't go their way and they have a privacy type interest.
So in ruling that the victim did not have standing, they relied a lot upon the Supreme Court's decision in Linda R.S. v. Richard D., 1973 decision, citing that in American jurisprudence, at least, a private citizen lacks a judicially cognizable interest in the prosecution or non-prosecution of another. Appellant does have an interest in the support of her child, but given the special status of the criminal prosecutions in our system, we hold that the appellant has made an insufficient showing of direct nexus between the vindication of her interest and the enforcement of the state's criminal laws. And pardon me, that did talk about a little bit different, you know, situation, but the main takeaway is that a private citizen does not have a right in a court-martial or a prosecution proceeding.
Yeah, think about how that's expanded. So basically what the court, in using that Supreme Court precedent, is saying is victims do not have a right in the prosecution, or do not have a stake in the prosecution of the person that they are accusing of committing an offense against them. Flat out saying it. Not a party to the offense. It's the United States versus the accused, not the private individual versus the accused. So taking that to the extreme, they're saying a victim does not have a right in whether or not the accused is convicted.
However, interestingly enough, the CAF said that an abatement essentially ends a prosecution. So the one party that would have standing was the government, and they could have done that through an Article 62 appeal. And we all know that you are very, you know, accustomed to handling those and explaining those. Dustin, what's an Article 62 appeal?
Yeah, an Article 62 is an interlocutory appeal that the government can start. So, I mean, normal appeals happen after the case is decided. In the military, they happen after convictions, because that's the only cases that the CCAs and the CAF are reviewing typically. The exception to that is an Article 62, where the government has a significant ruling going against them. So under Article 62, the government can appeal rulings that end the case or keep out some sort of evidence that's issued dispositive towards the prosecution of an offense. Those are the two main ones. There's three other categories, but those are the two main ones that you see most often. There is case law that talks about an abatement being equatable to a dismissal in certain circumstances. And this could be one of those circumstances potentially, because if the victim's never going to waive her privilege, the judge is never going to lift the abatement. So the abatement is basically consistent with a dismissal in this case. So the government would have a right under Article 62, arguably.
Sure. And so because of that, you know, they decide it's going to be abated, abatement's going to stay. And that goes to the question of the disqualification of the military judge. And they say, kind of like NMCCA, hey, the case is remaining abated. There's no need to disqualify the judge. It's not ripe. Also about the returning records to privileged and protected status. Hey, the records are sealed. Issue is moot. So going on to that second certified issue about the circuit split, I mean, is there a constitutional exception or not? Well, once again, we're not going to get an answer. So they said, hey, regardless of whether we answered the question in the affirmative or in the negative, we could not provide any relief requested by the named victim, i.e. lifting the abatement order, disqualifying the military judge, and protecting the medical records. We don't do advisory opinions.
So taking that this is a case that really doesn't solve any of the issues that were presented before them, what can practitioners take away from this ruling, sir?
Well, number one, if you're a victim's legal counsel or a special victim counsel, depending upon your service, or I'm sorry, a victim's counsel is in a different service. So the first thing, if you're going to try to challenge an abatement, you've got to get the government on your side. And the government has to do it. The only means to challenge an abatement, the CAF is telling us, is through Article 62, the interlocutory appeal. So the government has to take, you know, the lead on this. Now, again, if you're VLC, SVC, VC, you know, maybe look at this, the possibility of waiving privilege. You know, right now, this material in this case seems like it would have hurt the victim's case for getting justice, but in other cases they found that there's stuff that's not actually constitutionally required in there, and so it might not be produced anyway. So just having eyes open to see what is actually in those records, and you know, if it's worth just waiving for in-camera review by the military judge. You know, if for military judges, you know, I think if they find privileged materials commingled in a situation like this, you know, the options that were given by the other judges. And so I should pause for a second. So with this case, there were two concurring opinions. Yeah, you had Chief Judge Olson write one, and then Judge Sparks joined with he wrote the opinion of the other one, and Judge Johnson joined him in that one. So in those concurring opinions, they gave some advice or maybe passed ahead for military judges. So if finding privileged materials, you know, one option would be either going under 513E, just go under that psychotherapist procedure, or another one would be immediately returning the documents. You know, as soon as you say see a record that says, hey, patient says stop, return the documents to the facility and say, hey, try again. And both concurring opinions said, hey, maybe all parties could do a stipulation of fact as to those diagnoses, treatments, et cetera, which, you know, if I'm a good defense counsel, I'm probably not going to be really interested in that idea. They also offered an idea of a stipulation of expected testimony from a psychotherapist. And then probably the best option going forward, and I think we're starting to hear this from the fleet in the field, is the idea of an affidavit specifically from the mental health provider or in essence, interrogatories, discovery request specifically to that mental health provider saying, hey, answer these, you know, few questions and only those questions. Other interesting thing on that second issue is that Chief Judge Olson kind of signaled that he believed Payne O'Brien case to be correct, that there's constitutionally required materials that you should abate, which is interesting because he also wrote the Bouget opinion, in which case there's a lot of language that seemed to support the idea in the other direction. So we'll see where how this ends up.
Maybe we'll find out one day, but not today, it seems like.
So in the end, the one solid takeaway is we know how an abatement can get to the calf, and we have some good ideas on how to possibly deal with these materials going forward.
Yeah, so that kind of ends our analysis of a really complicated case that's really about nothing, I think is a fair way to put it. I mean, just standing for appellate nerds out there, like that's really what it's about. But no real answers on the 513 puzzle that we've been trying to put together for years now since the rules been changed. Anything else for the field or fleet, sir, based on this opinion?
I really just love how you brought a Seinfeld reference into the podcast.
I did. I had to reach into the Wayback Machine for that one. Well, thank you all for listening. We hope to catch you next time. And as always, please hit the subscribe button and rate and review us 5 stars. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The court will stand in recess until further order of the court.